Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. Justin's here.
Hey, everybody.
How's it going?
It's been a week.
Yeah. I agree. But, you know, things are okay. We are doing just a Twitter show this time. I should mention, we did make a decision on the programming of this podcast. We are closing in on our 130th episode. If it's not this episode, it'll be the next one. It'll be number 130.
Holy crap.
Yeah, and we've been doing this since 2009, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so, it's about 3 years now.
Yeah. With that comes sort of a lack of people to interview. We're sort of at the bottom of our list. Not the bottom of our list, but the list is dwindling in terms of
anything that you hear on the show from here on out, we don't really want.
It's not at all what I meant. It's just that, and there are some people that we kept meaning to have on that we still have not had on for whatever reason.
Yeah, there's actually a big list of those.
Yeah, but, you know, that's because those are really hard to schedule. And we can nail someone like that down, like, once every few months. So I know we've been doing a lot of these shows where it's just kind of us talking about what we've been watching, but people seem to like those anyway, so I'm not too concerned about that, but from here on out, what we're basically going to aim for is two of these shows where we're just talking about anime and what we've been watching lately and take Twitter questions, and then two interview shows a month. And likely they'll come, it'll depend on the scheduling, but likely it'll be every other week one of these, every other week an interview. So that's what to expect, I guess, from here on out. That's what the attempt is going to be. Anyway, so that aside, I know it's been a busy week. Have you been watching anything?
No. You know, one of the giant time sucks for me this week has actually been a massive Blu-ray project, an anime Blu-ray project.
Yeah.
And when that happens, when I get into production mode, I can't watch anything for fun. My brain isn't wired that way.
Yeah, you gotta read or something and just
get
away from the screen. Yeah.
Get away from anime, at least.
Yeah, it's important. You know, it's your job. You gotta take a break from it at some point. I actually have been watching something. A couple of things, actually. A couple of weeks ago, I sort of announced, like, hey, I'm going to finally watch Tiger and Bunny. And I got a bunch of people saying, like, hey, oh, I hope you like it. Like, you know, and I never made it past, like, maybe the third episode the first time around.
Mm-hmm.
And so this time I tried again and got distracted by the new Loop on the Third. Watched that instead. This time I made it up to episode 8 and got distracted again. This time by the fact that we have to program for the, or I need to start compiling my list of stuff I need to watch and or revisit for the Revenge of the Aughts show, which I should mention is now happening in October. So sorry, guys, we need more time. But I got distracted again, and I like the show. I like the show, but I'm really afraid that it's just not really holding my interest. There's something about it that I get very easily distracted while I'm watching it.
I had the exact same problem, and I can't. It's really hard to put my finger on why. I think maybe it's just a little too safe.
Yeah, I mean,
just a hair.
I don't. Yeah, I mean, I like the main character a lot, and the supporting characters are good too. Maybe it's just okay. So I'm on episode 8 now, and the plot is actually fairly convoluted. Like, they've got a lot of balls in the air. I don't know how far you initially got in it.
I think I bailed at episode 6 or so.
Okay, yeah, because they've got, like, 3 different plot threads going on at the same time. And it's not... It's interesting, but it's not... I kind of wanted... Maybe you said, like, maybe it's a little too safe. I feel like the minute they start going down the whole, oh, secret society and tragic backstory and mystery backstory stuff, I kind of start tuning out. I don't know why that storyline, that type of storyline, just has a hard time engaging me, but...
Well, that's what I actually mean by safe. There's a lot of very well-worn tropes in that show, and some people really like that, but that is exactly what a lot of people are looking for, but I get bored of that stuff.
Well, okay, so, like, the last episode I watched introduces the concept of, oh, well, if you have a hero that's just killing criminals, so he's not saving them like most superheroes would, and putting them in jail only for them to escape again. They're introducing the whole concept of, like, oh, well, why do we need regular superheroes if there's one guy who's just willing to kill the criminals and then we don't have to deal with him anymore? Which has been done in Marvel and DC Comics approximately 800 billion times.
That's not a new fictionalized issue.
It's not. And frankly, like, I don't think the show's doing anything all that interesting with it. Like, I don't know. It's, again, I have to stress this. Like, it's a really high quality show. It's nice to see something like this getting produced now. You don't see a lot of stuff like this get produced. The characters are fun. The story's okay. It's nothing to write home about, but it keeps you entertained. There's something about it. I'm very easily distracted while watching it, and I sort of wondered if this might be the case. It's 26 episodes. 25, I think. For whatever reason, and this is sad to admit now, but that seems really long to me. I get up to like episode 8 and I'm like, oh, this will be over in like 4 ep- no, no, there's another 15 after this.
Well, time for episode 12. Oh, shiny thing.
Yeah, pretty much. The 26 episode format, I think people, like, just over the years, we've gotten so used to 12 and 13 episodes and the story completing in 12 or 13 episodes, usually not that well, but it's over in 12 or 13. And a 12 or 13 show, if you're watching it, you can do it in 2 days. No problem.
You have to be a really good show to get people to sit through that much, you know, 26 episodes.
Yeah. And so far, like, from what I've seen, and I'm going to keep watching it. I'm gonna keep trying. Because, again, I do like it. And the fact that I can't put my finger on why I'm so easily distracted while watching it means that I need to give it more of a shot.
Right.
I think I'm just so used to 12 or 13 now that 26 seems like it's like, oh man, this is going to take a week to get through this. And that's just too much time. I got so much other crap to watch. But yeah. So Tiger and Bunny, again, I feel like I don't have enough praise for that show, and yet I can't explain why, for whatever reason, I don't seem to really want to watch it that much. I don't know. But the thing that totally distracted me was compiling this list of stuff I need to watch and revisit for the odds. And, yeah, there's a lot. It's a huge list.
You spent a lot of time watching very specific shows in the odds, didn't you?
Yeah. Very specifically, like, the most critically acclaimed stuff. And I went through periods of burnout where I wasn't really watching that much anime.
Right. I spent a lot of the odds burned out myself.
From 2003 to about 2006... in there is when I worked at Anime Insider, and we only watched the big shows, and there was no reason for me to do the season preview, so I wasn't watching everything then. It was a limited selection of stuff that I actually watched. So I missed a lot of stuff. I never watched Kino's Journey.
Oh, really?
Yeah, never saw it.
Oh,
so
shit.
So that's on my list. I never finished Gurren Lagann. I never saw all of Mind Game. I've seen bits of it, but not the whole thing.
Huh.
Yeah, there's a lot of shit that I need to revisit. In fact, I have the list here in front of me, and it's not fully compiled yet because I keep getting reminded of stuff that I need to revisit. But the list currently has something like 35, 37 titles on it.
Oh my god!
And this is the full list of shows that I'm considering.
Okay.
A lot of this is stuff not a lot of it. I would say a third of it is stuff I don't need to rewatch.
Okay.
But that still leaves me with over 20 shows that I have to look at again. So I totally... I'm starting out with Gurren Lagann, Roz Afon, Mind Game, and Haruhi Suzumiya, which I need to revisit because I actually never finished. So gotta watch that. I don't know if it'll be on the final list, but this is all stuff I gotta look at again.
Right.
I don't know if you're... You probably don't need to revisit anywhere near as much stuff as I do.
No, my viewing does have some conspicuous holes in it. Like, I've never even seen Roz Afon.
Okay.
But when I got back into it in a pretty major way in the mid to late aughts, I made a pretty serious effort to catch up on everything that everyone told me that I had missed.
Yeah.
So I don't really feel like I'm missing anything, but my memory of the decade is hazy. So I have to really, really study that list and figure out what I need to do, because I'm not quite sure how I'm going to handle this decade yet.
I'll send you the list that I have, and you can just take a look at it.
Okay. See if I appreciate that.
There's some stuff on here I'm actually really looking forward to watching, because I just never saw, like, Planetes. I never saw that. I saw the one.
Oh, really?
I saw one episode of it. Said, oh, this seems good, and then never saw more of it.
Yeah.
So that's on the list. I've been told Tokyo Magnitude is really good.
That's on my list.
I never saw that.
Yeah, that's a hard one because it was never licensed.
A lot of the stuff, again, I think it's a lot of this stuff came out in that period I was talking about.
Yeah.
And these were not shows that were advertising in the magazine, or we didn't think that putting them in the magazine would sell copies, which is how Wizard Entertainment worked back in the day, guys, believe it or not.
Princess Tutu, when it first came out, was a legendary flop.
Yeah, and doing a big feature on it would have been considered a waste of time. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's fun to it is a lot of. I've been really enjoying just going back through this and figuring out what's going to go on there and what's not. I had to check the release date on Eden of the East, which is apparently right at the end of 2009. So I don't know. We'll see. But then again, so was Redline. So who knows? I don't know.
I mean, it's also recent. It's hard to tell. Just, you know, what. Yeah, I'm just lost. Just mentally paging through the decade.
Yeah, it's tough. But hey, we put a lot of effort into those shows, and it pays off, because a lot of people listen to them. So, yeah, it's totally worth it. Okay, well, do we have anything else, or should we just get to Twitter?
Let's just get to Twitter.
All right, so we got a lot of Twitter questions and some email questions. So we should just go ahead and get started here. Okay, first up, NeoCloud9 asks, if you're a prisoner on death row, what would you choose as your last meal? Probably a harder question for you to answer.
Depends on what season it is. if it's summer, and actually I've thought about a similar question to this very recently, quite a lot. If it's summer, a chilled honeydew melon and ceviche.
That sounds good.
Yeah. If it's winter, perfectly brewed Japanese sencha, green tea, and simmered pumpkin.
And then they put a cafeteria steak in front of you, and that's it.
I'll take the steak, too.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't really have an answer for that. Big bowl of mac and cheese. So don't allow myself to eat that shit anymore, but I still love it. Okay. Maybe lobster mac and cheese. That's good, too.
I ever have mac and cheese with, like, bacon and, like, kind of spicy?
No bacon, but yeah. I'm not a bacon person at all.
I'm normally not, but I had this one mac and cheese with bacon on it that just, oh, so good. Anyway, we should move on.
Okay, and the others asks, would it violate your morals to download an episode of a show you own the DVD because it was altered on the disc, i.e. Beck episode 24?
No.
No, because I bought it.
Yeah, so. Quite the opposite. I consider that a license.
When I own something, when I went out and bought it and I need it in another format and I can't get it in another format, yeah, sure, I bought it. So I feel licensed to do what I will with it.
Right.
All right. Leonard Ryan 1 asks, he read my review of the show, so he's interested. Did you ever see Rin, Daughters of Namasini? You, Justin.
I saw a couple episodes. It was amusing, but it didn't really, you know, make me jump from the rooftops or anything.
Yeah. Okay. AngelXO3 asks, are there any underlooked anime titles from the 2000 to 2009 period you plan to watch for the first time? Yeah, I just mentioned a bunch of them, actually. I think the biggest one is Planetes, because I've heard nothing but, like, that's the most amazing show, and I literally have seen an episode of it.
It is a little hard to stick with. I think it's better an episode or two at a time rather than a marathon, because it's a little more episodic than we're used to.
Okay. Dear Gumendo asks, other than Kadokawa, what seems to be the rest of Japan's... What seems to be the rest of Japan animated distributors' opinion on American anime Blu-rays? Will others join?
Terrified.
Yeah.
It's been a huge, huge, huge issue. Mm-hmm. There are solutions being worked on, but it's getting really tough.
Well, somebody pointed out that, like, if you go on Amazon Japan and you look at the top selling Blu-rays, it's all reverse imported American stuff.
It's pretty common for, like, even a even a Blu-ray where you can't turn off the subtitles, even those are getting ranked above the legal Japanese releases now.
Whoops.
Yeah, so this is actually, you know, people are like, oh, we don't know how big an issue this really is. Well, no, we don't. And even the Japanese producers don't think it's more than a few hundred copies. But, you know, that few hundred copies at Japanese prices, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, that's their margin.
Yeah. So, I mean, that I don't blame them for being freaked out on this. Now, the good news is, you know, people are working really, really, really hard on a technical solution to this. And hopefully one that will be mostly invisible to the viewers. And I you know, won't require any new weird onerous protections or anything. So we will see what happens. I think we're going to be okay, but that we're still a little bit on a precipice here.
Yeah. Hopefully they can come up with a solution to that. I'd be pissed too if I'm like, you should be like, we put this out for $80 for two episodes, and then I go on Amazon and everyone's just buying the cheapo American
release. Yeah, the $50 one that has all 13.
Yeah. Okay, and the exchange rate's in their favor, too.
Right.
So, yeah. All right. Ed Sizemore, your friend of mine, asks, do you think that HD technology has caused anime companies to improve the animation quality? Are shows coming out today better looking than shows from 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago?
I think so.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you look at a middle-of-the-road show today that, like, has middle-of-the-road production values. Take Chihayafuru, for example.
Yeah.
Fairly middle of the road. Now compare that to anything middle of the road from the 90s. Anything.
Yeah, you're right. Now, I think specifically once they moved from film into the early days of digital, that stuff...
Yeah, that was a little bumpy.
That didn't look so good. But now that they've moved into full HD, it looks a lot better than it did in the... You know,
yeah, they had to invent a lot of ways to soften the look of digital because that was just so harsh at the beginning.
I remember the first show I ever saw that had digital pans. I think it might have been... Oof. I think it might have been Saber Marionette J.
Ooh. And I looked again, was, Saber Marionette J,
yeah,
again.
Yeah. And looking, it's just like, ouch, that looks terrible.
Yeah, that looked bad. Even like Bubblegum Crisis Tokyo 2040 looks pretty rough.
Yeah.
Hell, even Fruits Basket looks rough.
Yeah, Fruits Basket looks really rough. That is,
yeah.
That is a cheap-ass looking show.
I personally thanked Funimation for not attempting an upscale.
Yeah, no kidding.
Sure that would not have gone well.
I'm sure they wanted to. Okay. He also asks, has computer animation caused more similarity in character designs? That seems to me to be more of a market thing.
Yeah, but also I think there are... The way that they draw the in-betweens now, I think, does lend itself to much more simplified faces. There's not a whole lot of room for, like, crazy articulation, but we're also we're talking mostly about TV content that has to be produced really fast and cheap, so
yeah.
Even if it was still animated by hand, I'm not sure we would have gotten that. We probably would have just gotten stuff where the head was bigger than the body.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. The sameness of anime character designs, I do think, is more attributable to the market and what the market actually wants. And the market totally wants that same cute girl stereotype sort of looking thing. And that's why we get a billion of them every season.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what sells. Okay. Also from Ed... He asks, what do you think are the distinguishing visual characteristics of the main studios? For example, how can you tell Madhouse from Production IG?
You can't.
It kind of depends. I notice things about Production IG's animation style. They do have a little bit of an in-house style. You can kind of see it. But you have
yeah,
to really
but let's be
it.
Honest. Unless someone told you or unless you read what it was, I don't think you'd be able to identify it.
I've been able to pick it out before, but then again, I can do that with American animation studios too. I tend to pay really close attention to movement, and there are stylistic choices that you can tell based on the studio. Oh, this was animated by this particular studio or that particular studio. You can tell. It's not like the biggest
really?
Deal in the world. It's not super obvious. But
there are certain individual animators I can tell, but.
Yeah, it's much easier to tell with an animator than a studio. Like, I could, if I'm watching something and it's got the particular hallmark of this guy, maybe I could pick that out. But to say, yeah, I guess you're right, like, to say, like, oh, this was animated by Madhouse, only occasionally are there
little... I take that back, actually. Shaft, I think, has a very obvious look.
Yeah, Shaft has a really obvious look. For years and years and years, Tokyo Movie Shinsha, which still has that style, all their stuff kind of looks the same. They use the same sort of smirk on almost all their characters. You can totally tell.
Right.
But that's very specific to them. Production IG and Madhouse, I think, are more... you're less likely to find stylistic characteristics that are indicative of the studio. More likely you will find stylistic characteristics indicative of the animator or the director.
I can tell Studio Ghibli.
Yeah. Yeah. That's easy enough.
Yes.
I really wish that one day they would just do something else. It would be great. A new style. Something different.
That's the problem with success. It sure breeds laziness.
Yeah. All right, GBUFO asks, was there a current season anime that both of you look forward to and were disappointed by the end of it? I am not watching anything from this season.
I gave up on it. I'm not still watching it, so I'm not sure I can say it how it ended, but Natsuyuki Rendezvous sure started off strong, and boy, did it lose my interest.
Yeah.
Yeah, it after the first few episodes seemed really promising, and then it just starts spinning its wheels and kind of losing its direction and its momentum, and the characters stop being interesting. It's just like,
Yeah. I don't think I even watched the first episode of that. It's one of those I never got to. I kept being told to get to it. And there's stuff that I liked, but, man, these days I just wait for someone else to say, like, oh, it wrapped up, and it was pretty good. And then I'll go watch it.
Once you've been burned so many times, why would you do anything else?
Yeah. Plus, it's just easier for me. For whatever reason, I prefer to watch stuff marathoning it.
I do the same thing.
I would rather just get through it. All right. Again from Ed. Not trolling. Serious question. Why is it wrong to ask for an autograph at the end of an interview with someone at a convention? Because that's really unprofessional fanboy behavior.
Yeah. My problem with autographs is that it is a declaration that you are under a certain person.
Yeah, we've talked about this before.
Yeah, I know.
I don't agree with you on that, but I am there in a professional capacity. I'm not here to be a fanboy. I'm not here to tell you how great you are and prostrate myself, you know, before your greatness or whatever. I'm here to interview you, and that's it. And there's a certain level of professionalism where you need to take your job seriously and not just be a, you know, if you do this for a living, if you're getting paid to do it, I don't understand why you would do that. Like, if you really want the guy's autograph, just go wait in line with everybody else. That's fine. I have no problem with that. But abusing, I feel like it's not only that, it's an abuse of your time. They're not there to give you an autograph. They're there to be interviewed and have their work promoted. So to me, it's a little bit of a violation of the contract that you sort of unspoken contract you enter into when you agree to do an interview with somebody.
Yeah. And most people are nice enough that they won't raise a fuss.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things that everyone in the room just kind of going, ugh.
Yeah, pretty much. I remember I was at a convention, it was Anime Expo like 4 or 5 years ago. And there was a guy who, Naito was there. And, this dude comes in with his backpack full of Trigun action figures, and he starts pulling them out in the press room, the green room for the press, waiting to go in and interview him. He starts pulling out all these action figures, and he goes, which one should I ask him to sign, you guys? And I said, don't ask him to sign anything. And he's like, well, why not? I'm like, because it's rude. And you're not in there to get his autograph. You're in there to ask him questions about his work, thoughtful questions about his work. And some of the people in there were a little bit baffled, but the people who actually were, you know, paid to be there, like, this was their actual job, they were like, yeah, don't ask him for his interview. I think it's just, like, not only that, if you want to be taken seriously as an interviewer or a journalist or whatever, and you want to be invited back to interview these people again or interview other clients that his PR representative might have, don't do it. They're not going to take you seriously if you bust out a sketchboard or whatever.
Yeah, they're not there to entertain you or give you a keepsake.
Yeah. Okay. Nemo Metison asks, Samurai 7 is a start, but which would you watch first? Tokyo Story, as produced by Kyoani, or Oshii's Far Future, Sancho the Bailiff? Hmm.
Wow.
Interesting question. Tokyo Story, produced by Kyoani, would be very interesting.
Yeah, I kind of really want to see that.
Yeah. Yeah, I would go with that. I'd be interested in an Oshii version of Sancho the Bailiff.
Yeah, but I'm a huge Ozu nerd, so...
Yeah. He also asks, you guys have any favorite Tony Scott films? Poor Tony Scott.
Yeah, that was really sad.
But anyway, so favorite Tony Scott films. I have to admit, like, I was never a huge fan of his, but he did a lot to change the way action movies look, for sure.
Yeah, I'm looking at his filmography, I'm just like, nothing really hitting me that I would name as a favorite.
You know, Top Gun's a classic. It's sort of hilarious, but it's right. A classic. I guess I enjoyed Man on Fire. He made some stinkers. He's mostly as the way, in terms of the way cinema looks, that's where he was a pioneer. That's where he really changed things up and changed the way a lot of action movies look. Story-wise, I mean, he made mass entertainment. But I wouldn't put any of his films in my top probably 50 movies, but... as a contributor to the visual language of cinema, his contribution cannot be downplayed. It was he had a big impact. Back, Ed, with this again. So if you got a rare chance to interview Miyazaki, you wouldn't ask to get your Nausicaa manga signed? No.
Boy, if you were going to get a stink eye from anybody asking for an autograph, probably be Miyazaki.
I'd ask him to put his cigarette out on it. Zero Intelligent asks... Any films you guys are looking forward to this fall or winter? The fall's coming.
Yeah, that new P.T. Anderson movie. Holy crap.
Yeah, it looks really good. That's the big one that sticks out in my head. Obviously, Django Unchained. I can't wait for that.
Yeah, I look forward to that, too.
I was really looking forward to The Great Gatsby, but, like, everything else has been pushed to next year. They pushed, like, half the fall slate to next year. I don't know why, but they did. I really want to see a 3D Baz Luhrmann movie. That sounds great to me.
I have no troubles forgiving a studio more time to get something right, because there's been so much garbage rushed out to market that wasn't ready. I'm quite happy to say, here, take another few months.
Well, specifically they're moving Gatsby out of the way of The Hobbit, because they were scheduled to open on the same day, I think.
Oh, God.
And they were like, well, we don't want to get fucking crushed, so let's move it to next spring or whatever. Fine with me.
That makes good sense.
And I think that was the reasoning for a lot of films that got moved out of December, is they're all fucking scared of The Hobbit. I would be, too.
Well, all the studios have taken such a bath this year. Like, it has been a bad year for the studios.
Yeah. There were some big flops, but the superhero stuff... still raised the grosses past, I think. I think it's yet another record-breaking year, but that doesn't mean everybody did well.
Well, yeah, I mean, not everyone tanked. There were a couple really, really huge successes, but, man, the failures have been huge, expensive ones, and yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if some people got fired pretty quick these days.
Oh, yeah, hey, what's his butt at Disney? His head rolled after John Carter.
Yep.
I was really shocked that no one got at least there was no public... firing of anyone for Battleship, which lost the same amount of money as John Carter.
It did slightly better overseas, and I think it was less of a shock.
Yeah. Still, what a flop. And he also asked, Justin, have you seen Wanga and Midnight?
I have not. Should I?
I guess maybe. He doesn't say. Okay. He also asked, Zero Intelligent, who's the one director, scriptwriter, producer, etc. you want to punch in the face or any other body part?
Just one?
I mean, truth be told, I would never actually hit anybody, but in a fantasy world, yeah, I feel like I would just at least like to see Michael Bay get kicked in the nuts. Just once. Just once. That's it. No more abuse than just that.
Yeah, that's a nice little fantasy. I'm going to go with that, actually. I might comfort myself next time I'm upset with that mental image.
Thanks for those Transformers movies, douchebag. Sewing Rose 11 asks, what do all digital Japanese movie theaters mean for their film industry? What are the advantages and disadvantages about it? Are they just now switching over?
Yeah, they're a year or two behind us. I mean, it's not a huge difference on any level, except if you're a theater owner.
It's a huge expense.
And it's way more environmentally friendly, because one major difference between how Japanese 35 distribution works and how it worked here is that when a 35mm print would finish its print run in the U.S., they would run it through a chemical process to try to get out all the scratches, and then they'd burn subtitles on it and ship them overseas. So they got a lot of use. And, you know, they would save a few, and then that would be it. The prints would be pretty much done by the end of their international run.
Yeah.
With Japanese release, they're so protective and obsessive about them not getting out. Once a film finishes its run, they just shred all the prints. So it's a lot less physical waste. But in terms of actual exhibition, Japan's theaters were so meticulously run that the end user probably won't even notice a difference.
Yeah. It's nice that they're switching over, though. I mean, I used to be like, oh, no, the death of 35mm or whatever. Now I'm just like, no. I can actually count on the projection standards to be consistent at this point, at least.
Right. Like, I'm just happy that, A, the audio is much clearer,
yep,
and, B, we'll never have to deal with the film break or a... You know, out of focus doesn't happen as much. Framing doesn't happen anymore. All the crap that can ruin a movie-going experience is fairly minimized.
Yeah. God, all that stuff is really annoying.
Now it's just the people.
Yeah, really. That's the biggest problem. I remember once we went to a midnight revival screening of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and the reel was so battered, it broke 6 times. And it was just covered in dirt. The dirtiest film print I have ever seen.
Yeah, that ruins it. And, you know, when a film prints that dirty, the digital audio can't pick up, and that drops out, and then you get a shitty mono soundtrack. That's no good for anybody.
Yep.
And those prints cost $1,000 a piece.
Yeah.
I mean, who wouldn't? And they weigh 70 pounds.
At the same time, yeah, there's nothing like perfectly pristine 35mm print being projected by an expert perfectly. Like, that looks amazing. Almost never happens.
Well, not only that, it's pretty rare that, you know, even when we were getting new release prints of new big movies, you know, they would run those in the hot bath. So everything would be a little blurry. We would not be getting a very clear picture. Like, the last few Harry Potter movies I saw, I was just like, damn it, why couldn't I see this digitally? You can see the titles of the letters just on, you know, the opening credits just kind of bleed into the substrate because it just didn't look good. It wasn't run through the bath properly. They cut all sorts of corners.
Yeah, that, and I noticed that for years when everything was just a little blurry and even a
little wobbly.
Yeah, like it was a brand new print, first screening of the day on a Friday, and it looked kind of shitty. And I would always wonder, like, why isn't this as clear as it is at, like, on tape or on DVD or whatever? Like, this looks pretty blurry.
There's so many apologists for the old way, and they always do have a little bit of a point. But after a while, the new way catches up. It gets improved.
Yeah, the last print I saw in 35mm that was absolutely perfect was a screening of Pee Wee's Big Adventure at CineFamily, and it was an amazing experience to see something that good projected that well, and the print was, like, really in good condition. However, that was the first... That was, like, after years and years of seeing everything in digital and not having seen anything in 35mm since then. That's the only thing I can point to as, like, oh, yeah, 35mm is great. Just look at this one time. It was great.
And I'm sure that was a specially struck studio print, you know, meant for special occasion viewing.
Yeah. They probably rented it from Warner, which was up the street, so...
Right.
You know. All right. Anyway, moving on. Okay, Alichat asks, any logic to who reviews what for ANN, or is there a rotation and each reviewer gets what is available when it's their turn? I got a couple of little questions like this. I guess people are a little confused as to how we select who reviews what. Basically, I get screeners in, I send out an email to our team of reviewers, which is... Theron, Carl, Carlo, and Rebecca Silverman, and I say, who wants what? And they divvy it up, and I mail the stuff to them, and then they review it. That's basically how it works. Bamboo and Aaron are not part of that ecosystem. They review whatever they feel like. But generally, that's how it goes. Right now, since there's so much streaming content, everybody just kind of divvies up what they're going to review themselves. But it's an entirely democratic process. They pick. I don't tell them what to do.
What happens when no one wants a show?
I make someone take it.
Oh.
Basically, like, if no one claims it, I say, who's going to take this? Someone has to take it. And then someone says, all right, I'll take it. But they're all pretty fair people. I don't think I've ever given something to someone specifically because it's like, oh, this guy's going to give it a bad review. I'm going to give it to him. Like, I don't think anyone has ever really operated that way because it's just not a good way to run a review organization. Yeah. But that is the logic. They pick what they want, and then they review it. Okay. Dr. Swerve asks, for Justin, it seems like you sometimes go on a tweet rant about some airlines. Are there any airlines that you will never, ever tell anyone to go on?
Yeah, Spirit.
And I've never...
Holy shit, that is the worst airline I've ever been on, and the only one that I've ever felt unsafe with.
Isn't that a regional airline?
Yeah, they're always the cheapest airline whenever I fly home to Detroit for, like, the holidays or something.
Oh, yeah.
And I flew them once, and, you know, most airlines have, you know, given a little bit more legroom. Not these guys. These are still, you know, the exact seat configurations from 1968.
Ugh.
And possibly the same upholstery.
Ew.
And, it's all, like, this dingy leather that looks like, you know, a white computer keyboard after about 3 years in a college college dorm.
Ew.
And everything just feels a little loose and rattly, and there is no on-flight anything. They were the first airline to think to charge you for carry-on bags, you know, just little things like that to just add up, and they're terrible, and I was so uncomfortable, and yeah, fuck Spirit Airlines.
Yeah, I try my hardest to stick with JetBlue or Virgin when I'm flying. Not always possible, but I try my hardest.
I honestly, most of the time I'm complaining about the airport, not the airline itself.
Yeah. Although for something like, because generally, like, I'm either flying here, so, like, to San Francisco or something, or, mm-hmm. like, to Arizona, which is, like, those are, like, an hour and a half long flights, so it doesn't really matter. But if I'm flying to the East Coast, I will go out of my way to pick an airline that I'm comfortable with, preferably one with a direct flight. That tends to be why I stick with JetBlue, because they do direct flights to, like, New York, and the plane is comfortable and has satellite TV in the seat. So, yeah. Okay. Jack Mace Rio asks, what are your favorite movie sites, blogs, and reviewers? I have a lot. I read a lot of movie reviews. I don't have a lot of favorites, but my favorite is Badass Digest right now. They have some of the best writers working for them, including this is the home of film crit Hulk, who is doing easily the best writing about movies out of anyone right now. That guy's amazing. Like, I don't know if you read his stuff, but he's full of nothing but insight. Like, he's really, really smart.
Really?
And really knows what he's talking about. Oh, yeah. You would love his stuff. You kind of have to get past his gimmick, but...
Right.
Once you get...
I think his gimmick is funny.
Yeah. And his writing is... It's brilliant. Like, he's really smart about movies. He generally takes on whatever topic of the day and looks at it from a million different angles and always comes to a really smart conclusion. Like, it's amazing writing. Devin Farachi, however you pronounce his last name, I really like his movie writing too. He's very honest, and he's not afraid to trash fanboy stuff if it's bad, if it's legitimately not good or worth questioning. He's honest about his shit. So yeah, that's
I actually don't read a whole lot of criticism these days. I go through Rotten Tomatoes, and, you know, if I recognize a name from a major newspaper or magazine or something, I'll click on it to see what they have to say, but not a whole lot of people come to mind immediately that I would remember by name.
Yeah. I like Mr. Beeks over on Ain't It Cool. He's pretty good. He's probably their best writer. A.O. Scott and the AV Club. I really like the AV Club. They do amazing work over there. Although their movie reviews are very short. Their TV coverage is a lot better than their movie coverage.
Their TV coverage, I think, sometimes gets a little too far up their own ass.
Yeah, well, and they cop to that.
And oh, do they?
Yeah, and they realize that, like, oh, we're obsessed with television. Then why are you here if you don't want to read that? Because that's what it is. It's these obsessive breakdowns of every episode of every show that they're covering.
Sure. I get a little... with the problem with television reviews, especially serialized television, is that it's when they have to do this ridiculous analysis on every episode, there's a very definite danger of missing the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
I don't think every episode of Mad Men should be assigned a letter grade. I just don't. And I don't think that this was a bad episode should even really be that important of a conversation, because a show like that is about the whole arc.
Well, no, I disagree with that. I think it's fun to read the review after. When I watch a show like Mad Men or Breaking Bad, I want to have a place where intelligent discussion about it is happening, and it's generally happening on the AV Club.
Oh, right. I mean, not to say I don't read those reviews or they're worthless, but I find them a little too nitpicky, judgy on something that I think should be judged by the whole arc.
Well, you know, people say that about us with anime, so...
That's true.
But people want that, they want that content, and it's fun to read. I agree the letter grades kind of suck, but we've, as everyone who works in the frivolous and world of entertainment journalism like we do, people want grades. They want them. You can't get rid of them. If you get rid of them, people will complain nonstop, and your traffic will go down. People want grades, so everyone uses them. Everyone I know that writes about this stuff for a living fucking hates letter grades or stars or whatever. But if we don't use them, people get really mad. So it's a matter of serving the audience. But I kind of agree with you in that it would be better, I think, if they just reviewed the episode and then at the end of the season gave the season a grade. Like, that would probably be better.
Yeah.
Okay. And the others asks, what's your best estimate for how many units sold Funimation considers a hit? What's the basis for your estimate? Do we know this and can't say?
No, I don't. The problem is we don't know how much they spend on dubs because it's all in-house.
Yeah.
With anyone using an outside vendor, it's fairly easy to guess how much the dubbing costs on a per-episode basis, but Funimation has in-house salaried staff, so it's a much harder guess.
Yeah, I don't know, but we do know that Lance said that we would not buy a show that we expected to only sell 3,000 units.
Right.
So we have to assume that it's higher 5,000? Than that. We don't know what they... I would... Gotta be more than that, right? I don't know. It's worthless to speculate. We don't know the answer to that. However, it's more than 3,000. We can say that for sure.
Right.
Okay. For some reason, it's not showing up in my Twitter feed, but we did get a question about whether or not we're watching The Newsroom, which I am. I don't know if you're watching that.
No, too many people warned me, and I was just like, okay, well, I won't bother.
It's bad.
Right.
I don't know why I'm still watching it. I think I kind of want to see how bad it's going to get. Because I really like Aaron Sorkin, and The West Wing is an amazing show. And The Social Network is an amazing movie, and he's done a lot of really great writing, and I like his stuff. But this is Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, Aaron Sorkin. the bad one. The one where he's just... Every episode seems like he's just dedicated to demeaning his female characters as much as he can. Like, this is a show where the, you know... Old guard, proud, you know, rich white newsman totally stands up to everybody and saves the day. And he's flawed, but in a good way. And all the women, all the female characters, all two of them, basically are shown in every episode to be ruled by their emotions and constantly kind of fuck things up and, you know, get jealous and crazy, and they have panic attacks. And, like, they're all, like... They're not very good at what they do. It's like, why are these characters just being singled out as like, oh, look at these weak women. Like, I know
we've secretly replaced this beloved showrunner with Neil LaBute. Yeah. Let's see if anyone notices.
Yeah, no shit. And he's done, like, Sorkin's kind of done this before, but like not to this extent. It's also extremely self-important. Like,
that's what turned me off. I saw the first episode and I was just like, okay, this is really. Really, yeah, no.
Well, and all you have to do is watch the opening credits. Like, the opening... I don't think the first episode had the opening credit sequence on it, but the opening credit sequence kind of just tells you how far up its own ass the show is. Like, it's clearly taking itself extremely seriously, and it's like, gravitas! Look at all this gravitas we have! And it's like, I don't think you have that much gravitas, because the show's not very good. But I kind of want to see how far... Because it... Again, that's one of those shows where I looked at the AV Club letter grades, and it was like C-, C-, D-, D+, and I'm like, oh, really? Like, wow. Oh, shit. But yeah, I don't know why I'm still watching it, but I am. Okay. Let's see here. Paul Freeland asks, He says, I put it to you that Idris Elba should be the next James Bond. Your thoughts? Would a black James Bond go over better than a black president of the United States? Sure, I mean, I would watch that. That would be interesting.
I have no real opinion. I'm not a huge James Bond fan.
No, I don't like James Bond, really.
Yeah, I mean, asking me what would be good for that franchise is like asking Michael Bay what would make a good art film.
It's the thing about James Bond that bothers me is that it feels like, hey, here's, you know, generic dad's power fantasy, like the movie. Like, generic dad wants the girl and the car, and he's a spy, and he kicks a lot of ass, and gets the girl, and has the car, and
the entire subgenre of parodies of that sort of thing are so much more entertaining than the thing itself.
Yeah.
I mean, why would you watch actual James Bond when you have Archer?
Sure. There you go.
You know? Way better.
I would much rather watch Archer. Yeah, I've never been a James Bond guy, but honestly, like, if they just brought someone else who was not just sort of, like, generic white guy, it might make it more interesting. Or at least change the politics of it a little bit or something. I don't know. Add something to it. A little change never hurt anyone. Okay, he also asks, would you rather see an Avengers sequel without Joss Whedon directing, or another Nolan Batman film with Robin Blake in the... Well, I don't want either of those things. I don't want another Nolan Batman film. We've had enough of them. And Joss Whedon did a really good job with the Avengers, so I want to see him do another one. Yeah. You obviously have no opinion on that.
I did not see either one.
Yep. Yeah, really sick of Nolan Batman. All right. Got a couple of questions here from Paul Freeland. Says, moving back to the U.S. after 4 years abroad, Medica Magica and Tiger and Bunny are locks. Any other must-watch titles you'd recommend? In the last 4 years, Rebuild of Evangelion, Summer Wars. I hate these on-the-spotters.
Yeah, I can never churn through my mental hard drive fast enough.
Eden of the East. But I liked that a lot more than a lot of other people did.
Trying to think what the last thing I bought that I was really excited to get was, anime-wise. I know there was something. Oh, Bunny Drop.
Right, that's out.
Yeah. Sweet. Love Bunny Drop. Yeah, that's good enough.
Yep, that should keep you busy for a little bit.
Yeah.
And we got some questions on email, so 1 second. Chin Flowen says, Dear Zach, I've been listening to the podcast since January 2012, and I've noticed that you seem to be less forgiving or open to a lot of shows. Carl Key, Aaron, and Bamboo are able to find the appeal of different shows like Another, Fate Zero, Cat Planet Cuties, Baka and Tess, Jormungand, and F, A Tale of Memories. I didn't watch any of those, so...
I saw Baka and Tess. It was amusing for a little while.
Well, it's just... I saw the first episode of Another, and I kind of made fun of it for being over the top. Ooh, spooky, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
None of those others I had an opinion on, though, so... not sure where that's coming from. He said, I would like to know if you wish you could be more open-minded. Oh, that's a backhanded question. Have the same passion as your fellow ANN writers. All right, the reason I'm asking this question, to understand if being open-minded to enjoy a show is just being ignorant of the faults or visible to the merits.
I think he's mistaking being judgy for being closed-minded here.
Yeah, I'm kind of a harsh critic.
Extremely harsh.
Yeah, I'm a harsh critic. I want quality, I want good, and I want to be honest about whether or not something really grabbed me. And I've seen so much anime at this point that I don't feel like I need to be the guy who makes apologies for everything.
Well, also, you're a very hardcore comedy nerd, so your bar for comedy is extremely high.
Yeah, I don't... Yeah. I seriously doubt... Baka and Test would make me laugh. I'll give it a shot, but I don't think it's going to make me laugh.
Yeah, don't even bother. Don't even bother. That's like, no.
But the fact of the matter is, like, I'm executive editor, which means I manage all of our writers, which means it's my job to bring on writers that disagree with me, that have different opinions from me, and I feel like we have a pretty diverse team of people who can find the quality in whatever it is they're reviewing, and I feel like the editorial team we have... means that I don't necessarily have to be the guy who's like, well, this show wasn't funny and the animation stinks, but if you look at it this other way, it's like, no, I can just say this show kind of stinks, here's this other person's opinion, here's five other opinions on it. Like, We are giving a lot of opinion on these shows, and it's diverse. People like to say A&N says this, A&N thinks that. But there is no one A&N opinion. There's six or seven of them. So I'm not the only guy writing for the site. And asking me if I wish I could be more open-minded, I am open-minded. I'm just not easy to please. So, yeah. There you go. Thanks for the weird backhanded question.
Yeah, I can't really find... I can't really blame people for getting a little butthurt sometimes. I admit I have totally gotten a little butthurt when something I like got a bad review.
I guess I'm just so far... Like, to me, the reviews are about discussing. When I read a bad review of something I really loved, it just gives me more to think about. I don't think of it as like, hey, but that's really good. It's like, okay, so we disagree, but let's have a conversation about it. Like, that's what's fun about art and art criticism is talking about it.
So, well, yeah. I mean, that's the healthy, smart way of looking at it. The base emotional way of looking at it is, oh, this really kind of made a big impact on me. You personalize it, and then someone goes, that was fucking stupid. Look at this. This is just a retarded thing. And you can't help but go, you shrink back a little, just like, oh.
Well, it's that thing where it's like, this show sucks. I'm not saying you suck. I'm saying this show sucks.
Right. It is a hard separation to make sometimes.
Yeah, look, I get it. We get it all the time, constantly. That is the chief reaction people have to negative reviews of things that they like. Is like, hey, you told me I'm shitty. Like, no one said that. But, that's the natural reaction, people. Okay. David Nyman asks, you guys have seen a lot of anime. I, too, have seen a lot of anime. Nope. Cool
Good
question.
For you.
Thanks, buddy. Yet, listening to you and your guests speak about Japanese cartoons is a humbling reminder that merely watching anime does not mean that you understand or know all about it. What are your takes on understanding anime, or the correlation between watching and understanding, at least experiencing? Are there areas that you would want to know more about, or some that you simply could not care less about?
I'm not sure I understand the question fully.
I think he's talking about, like, being able to put a show in sort of a historical context and talk about what came before and talk about the director's or the screenwriter's past work and all of that stuff. You know, the things that knowledgeable people like, Mike Toole tends to do, and Daryl tends to do that too, and... You know, you and I have our moments where we know what we're talking about, but when it comes to just, like, understanding it or knowing more about it, the encyclopedia is there. You can actually find out a lot about a show just by digging through the staff credits and, like, looking at what they worked on previously.
Yeah, there are a handful of shows that really knowing historical context really does help. Like, for example, only yesterday... Knowing who, that band is that she name drops is like, oh, okay, that helps. Or knowing why the historical reason why her dad gets upset when she goes out without her shoes, that helps.
Right.
But for the most part, if you're needing to dig that far just to get enjoyment out of a show, it's probably not a very good show.
Yeah. I mean, and there's something to the fact that you and I are both movie nerds who think about movies in a very specific way. And so
that's also true.
We approach anime that way as well. And so when we talk about things like narrative construction and stuff like that, it might seem like we're all highfalutin and stuff, but that's just how we think about movies.
We went to film school. We can't help it.
Okay. Also from David Nyman, he says, when discussing feedback on reviews, you've wished for some people to raise their level of discourse and actually engage in meaningful discussion about the art. What's a good starting point for an ordinary non-film school reviewer, mentioning that, to begin thinking critically about that which is being watched without ruining the viewing experience, and then remembering those thoughts for later discussion? How do you personally go about it? He says, as for me, I'm ashamed to admit that I'm a passive viewer. I shouldn't be ashamed of that. There's nothing wrong with that. And with most anime I watch, I don't really reflect on it to the degree that I would like. Well, interesting question. It's kind of a blessing and a curse to think about shit like semiotics when you're watching an anime.
Well, that's going a little far.
or analyzing everything you watch to the level that we tend to. It can make it so it's harder for you to enjoy things. I know it certainly is harder for me to enjoy simple pleasures.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to turn off. And the truth of the matter is, most shows don't really bear that much thought.
Yeah, right. I am overthinking it 90% of the time.
Oh yeah, same here. So, it's actually a big problem.
That's our fault. That's our flaw. You should be happy with the fact that you don't do that, and you can just sit there and enjoy
that
stuff.
That said, I do think that we get more enjoyment out of the really, really, really good stuff being able to do that.
Yeah, there's ups and downs. I would say it balances. Like, this guy says he's ashamed of being a passive viewer. There's no shame in that. Like, again, like, it might seem like I want this, you know, more meaningful discourse about the art. I do want more of that. That doesn't mean that I think anyone who's a passive viewer or just is basically just consuming is bad or shouldn't be part of the discussion or anything.
March them into the ovens.
Yeah. Jesus. But, yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. Whatever, however you gain enjoyment, this is supposed to be entertainment. So if you're entertained by it and you're happy being just entertained by it, then great. That's great.
Well, here's what I do. I mean, because it sounds like he's asking us just kind of like if he's looking to look deeper.
Yeah.
What's something to think about? And for me, what I like to do is if there is a particular character moment or a particular something that someone goes through or thinks about, I just try relating it to my own life and thinking about what that kind of experience is like. And by relating it to real life, you can kind of look a little deeper, see the details and see what was reflected and what wasn't.
Yeah, I personally like to look for themes and messages and underlying statements that the show is making. I really like looking for that stuff. So thematic consistency and whether or not the show's ultimate outcome supports what I think the theme of the show is or what they're really trying to say here is, to me, that's crack. Like, I love doing that. That's my favorite way to watch things. And again, that helps me enjoy the good stuff better because the good stuff tends to have that going on. Not a lot of anime has that going on, where there's really genuinely something in there and they're getting at a bigger picture message, and it isn't just fluffy, fun entertainment.
There's really not a whole lot to uncover for the most part, unless we're talking about a Satoshi Kon movie or an Oshii movie.
And the occasional TV show.
Every
once in a while you get one. Hey, and again, this isn't unique to anime. This is absolutely true for American television and movies as well.
I don't know, Zach. I could write essays on Jersey Shore.
Yeah, people have.
Yep.
There's socioeconomic implications in that show. but in terms of, like, if you just want to, you know, there's a Bible for this sort of thing. It's just a book called Film Theory and Criticism. I don't know what edition they're up to. I think they might be up in like 10 or 12, something like that. It's not a cheap book, but that is sort of the Bible of where modern film criticism and analysis comes from. Reading that, it's dry as fuck, and some of those essays are horribly boring. But there's stuff by like Sergei Eisenstein in there. That book will generally give you a really solid education in thinking about film as a visual art with real meaning and impact and depth on multiple levels, rather than just simple entertainment. So if you really want to see where some of our thought processes are coming from, just flip through that book. It will give you an education in film theory and criticism, like the title says. That'll help you out. So if you really are serious about it, check that shit out. It's totally worth it. And finally, okay, Chris A. asks, wondering if you guys have any clue as to how well Crunchyroll is doing after three of their most popular shows, Bleach, Gintama, and Beelzebub, ended a couple of seasons ago. They picked up a lot of new shows in the meantime, but I imagine their bunch of subscribers will only subscribe to Crunchyroll for one of these, Bleach especially.
I'll bet they took a hit after Bleach, but I haven't seen any numbers from them recently at all.
We have no idea how they're doing, we don't want to speculate, but we haven't heard any bad news. So, insofar as I can tell, they're doing fine. I don't really know. We don't get a lot of information about Crunchyroll and how exactly it is that they're doing. I don't know. They seem to be okay. I would imagine they took a big traffic hit after Bleach.
Right, but possibly mitigated by all their presence on video game consoles now. That was probably a real big feather in their cap.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I watch Crunchyroll on my iPad. looking forward to having it on my PS3. I use the service all the time. Constantly, in fact. Okay, and he also asks, why do you think those shows stopped all of a sudden? Why did Shonen Jump pull the plug? They all seem to be doing pretty well.
Bleach was not doing well in Japan.
Yeah, Bleach was failing, right?
Yeah, it was pretty low rated.
And the other two...
Beelzebub, I don't know anything about.
Yeah, I have no idea. I hate it when we get these questions and we're like, I don't know, we don't know. Okay, well, hey, that about wraps it up for this time around. Dustin, thanks for coming on by.
Always a pleasure.
All right, see y'all next week.